I think it's Boer Brew. I'm not sure.
Uh-huh. And so what would you like to, because this affects tribal policies here as well. In fact, all across the country, this has a ripple effect.
My purpose is to go and witness and then report back to the people. So I am on a nation tenacious status, which means that my report needs to help people to the people that are part of the system, the tribal system and the government to government thing, to understand what they're actually walking into. And then it's up to the people to really decide.
Thanks so much, Pat. We're out of time now. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, November 2nd, 2015. Kate Welch engineered the show for us today. Thanks, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Cable Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a dance party benefit for Safer Streets on Saturday, November 7th at 9 p.m. at Crush in Portland. Safer Streets offers free self-defense classes in various easily accessible locations for women in the Portland metro area who are experiencing homelessness, poverty, mental health or addiction issues, for sex workers, and for survivors of violence or abuse. Safer Streets is queer and trans friendly and welcomes and meets attendees at their particular needs or abilities. That's a dance party with DJ Aurora to benefit Safer Streets, Saturday, November 7th, 9 p.m. at Crush, 1400 Southeast Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Burns, senior host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. For 40 hours last August, kayaktivists and Greenpeace climbers delayed the Royal Dutch Shell Oil icebreaker MSV Fenica from leaving the Portland shipyard, where it was being repaired, to head back to Shell Oil's drilling operation in the Arctic. A few weeks later, Shell announced that it was abandoning its plans to find oil under the seabed off the coast of Alaska. And shortly after that, the Obama administration announced that it was canceling all oil leases in the Arctic for the next 2 years. This morning, we talk again with Sightline Institute's Eric DePlace and Nick Abraham about why this change of heart for Shell and the Department of Interior. Eric is the policy director for Sightline, and Nick is a fellow at Sightline and editor of Oil Check Northwest. Eric and Nick, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Well, thanks for having us back on.
I sort of think of you as my new co-hosts. So
I'm flattered by that.
Yeah,
that's great.
For the Seattle branch of Locus Focus. Well, I was thinking this morning about the interesting timing of this show. Like the last time I had you on, it turned out that we had planned the show months in advance. It turned out to be the week that the Fenica was in the Portland shipyards getting repaired, and the protests were heating up around the St. John's Bridge. And I had a number of people saying that they were just so pleased that I was able to pull the show together like that, and it was totally serendipity. And it's the same thing this week. I'm not sure if you guys are aware that Portland City Council is having a hearing on Wednesday about preventing any fossil fuel terminals from being built in the Portland area. So
I am aware of that. Okay. I think it's just a fantastic development that really signals the kind of sea change we've been talking about, you and I have been talking about for a couple of years now. And the protests over the Shell drilling rig were in some ways a lead up to what we're seeing now, where, you know, this region really is starting to coalesce as, you know, what I like to call a thin green line, which is this wall of opposition to fossil fuel projects. And I'm extremely excited about what's going on in Portland right now. It's just really neat to watch.
So we'll talk a little bit more about that later on. But I just thought the timing again was impeccable. That because I found out of this meeting, the hearing, way after we scheduled the show. So let's start out by talking what we were going to talk about this morning, which is about the change of plans, the change of heart for both Shell and I also think the Obama administration as far as drilling in the Arctic. And I thought before we get into that, maybe we should just do a little bit of a review of what happened last summer, what Shell Oil's plans were to drill up there, and kind of what happened to those plans.
Sure. Nick, why don't Nick take that?
Nick's
probably the expert on Shell right now.
Okay. And so this is Nick Abraham we're going to hear from right now.
So last year, earlier this summer, Shell, it seems like it's been so long since we've had so much happen since then. But this last summer, Shell sent a fleet of ships up to the Arctic to drill for oil in the kind of untapped region of the Arctic. It was a very remote area. There was quite a bit of protests in Seattle when they docked at the city for a few repairs, and even more spectacular news gathering protests in Portland when one of their repair ships came down to fix a breach in its hull. Shell went up to the Arctic, spent about 2 months there drilling, and came out with nothing. They had to abandon their efforts and kind of gave their own moratorium, saying that they had spent a significant amount of money up there and that they were no longer going to be able to pursue this for the foreseeable future.
What I find kind of interesting about that was, I think we talked about this last time, a big part of Shell's motivation for drilling in the Arctic was that their stock price was threatening to plummet because they didn't have the proven oil reserves that they said that they had, and so they needed to prove that they had these oil reserves in the Arctic. So I wonder, it seems like there was an awful lot at stake for Shell to actually come up full-handed as opposed to empty-handed with the drilling they did in the summer. So what does this say that they, in spite of stock price pressures, are abandoning their Arctic dreams?
It's a huge blow to their company profile. They needed to get something up there. They needed to at least have the potential for future drilling up there, and with their abandonment of it and the Department of Interior's announcement that they were not going to issue drilling leases for the next 2 years, it's a huge blow for them. And besides their stock price and sort of market fluctuations, they spent $7.4 billion on this project, and to come back with nothing to their investors is a huge blow to the company.
I wonder what this says about the future of Shell Oil.
You know, they're still an enormous company. They have lots of other assets all around the world. But as far as future projections, I think this is something that all oil companies are going to start having to see as an issue. You know, with oil prices around the world still riding about $50 a barrel, there's lots of oil that companies have been going after for the last 5 years or so when prices were more around the $100 barrel range, where it made sense. You know, if you look at the tar sands in Canada, if you look at Arctic drilling, some of the sort of deep water Gulf projects, a lot of those don't make sense anymore at $50 a barrel. And these companies are starting to see that if they can't go after these really tight oil deposits, these ones that are in these remote areas, the harder to reach places, they're going to run out of reserves much quicker than they thought. And it's going to be a huge windfall for the entire industry to take a look at this internally.
What do you mean it's going to be a windfall for them to take a look at it?
It's just going to change the industry. If you know, things like they need to realize where their projections are going to go, and if they can't go after these areas, they're going to have to completely change what their market valuation is and where they're headed.
And maybe switch to renewable energy or something like that.
That would be the hope, but I'm not holding my breath for that.
Well, I'm kind of curious. It seems like if the relatively low price of gasoline these days is making it too expensive to drill after unconventional sources of oil, then the reserves will be depleted, and then the price of gasoline will go up again, and then it'll be more cost-effective or make more sense to go after the tar sands and Arctic oil. So I wonder if we're just kind of at the trough of a cycle that's about to ebb again.
You know, oil prices are an incredibly complicated system. There's, you know, it's not a strictly it's not a completely unchanged market. There's lots of price manipulation. There's lots of lying and obfuscating about how much reserve certain companies or countries have, and it's very volatile. It's one of the world's most confusing markets, and there's experts all around the world that get this wrong all the time. But I would agree that I think there's going to be a lot of ebb and flow in the next couple of years, especially with what happens in the Bakken, what happens in Saudi Arabia. You know, to sort of undercut the huge explosion that happened in the Bakken region, that all of a sudden the United States was turning into a net energy exporter, which completely changed the market. And Saudi Arabia dumped a whole bunch of oil onto the market to try and undercut that. But I think there's a limit to how long they can do that for, and it's gonna be really interesting to see how it fluctuates in the next few years.
Well, this wasn't actually on the agenda for today, but let's talk a little bit about the Bakken, since that really has been driving the price of oil for the last few years. And this hearing that is going to happen at City Hall, the City Council of Portland, on Wednesday, is basically, there's two parts to it. One of them is to prevent the building of any fossil fuel terminals, like the proposed Pembina liquid propane terminal that got torpedoed last summer, or the proposed, it would be like the proposed Tesoro Savage terminal, a gigantic terminal that's being planned for Vancouver, Washington. But if these terminals aren't built, and then on the second part of the hearing is about stopping oil trains, or at least really regulating oil trains coming through this region. If we slow down, or if not stop, the oil trains coming through the region and we don't have any terminals, what's that going to do to the efficacy of continuing to drill for oil and gas in the Bakken?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And the answer to it ends up being rather complicated, because you know, I think, as most folks know, oil is a fairly fungible commodity. It tends to flow to markets where there's demand for it. But you know, you kind of hear this sort of line of reasoning from the industry all the time, that something like, well, the oil will find a way there, or the coal will find its way there. But it's not magic. It can't just like fly there. It needs physical hard infrastructure to reach its markets. And so that's one of the really interesting things that we're seeing in the Northwest, is where we have kind of comprehensive region-wide dedicated campaigns to opposing the construction of new infrastructure, or in the case of this Portland resolution that you mentioned, preventing sort of, you know, any permutation of the industry, of the infrastructure getting built there at all. It definitely does begin to close off their access to markets. And, you know, absent a market that oil can reach at a price that can support the production, the stuff doesn't get drilled. So, you know, one of the things that Sightline and some others have been starting to do is to figure out, kind of on an analytical basis, well, what is the empirical case that we can make for showing that that preventing the construction of infrastructure drives down the drilling of the oil at all. And we'll be releasing some research within the next couple of weeks, I think, that will try to put some numbers on that. And, you know, but the upshot is, I think it's not giving too much away to say, is the upshot is that when the Northwest takes these stands, we can demonstrate with some economic modeling that it puts a hammer down on Bakken production. I mean, there are a few other places that Bakken oil can go, but this is a big destination for them, particularly by rail. And so we really do have an increasing amount of evidence to show that this is locking up carbon in the ground that would otherwise get extracted.
Well, last summer, you talked a lot about choke points, and I remember you and I had an email exchange about the kind of symbolic choke point of the St. John's Bridge, which was very visceral to watch how this ship had such a hard time getting past the St. John's Bridge and the railroad bridge, which another protester locked himself to the bridge so that it couldn't go up and for the ship to pass. So what, when you talk about there being a choke point here in the Northwest as far as getting this oil that's being drilled in the middle of the continent to markets, primarily in Asia, though some of them are also markets in California, what do you mean by that, and how graphic is that image of the St. John's Bridge? I mean, how does that really reflect on just what this choke point is that you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I did. You know, the imagery from that protest at St. John's was just riveting to me because, I mean, there, you know, as you just said, there's this choke point. The river is fairly, I mean, for the Columbia, it's a huge river, obviously, but it's fairly constrained there. And you could see, you know, I thought the imagery was just really powerful, like human bodies basically blocking this, you know, an auxiliary ship to the drilling fleet from heading out. And, you know, the contention that I make, and this is true with coal and oil and gas and some other commodities to a degree, it's not entirely true, but it's true to a degree, that if you kind of got this swath of coast between basically Prince Rupert, British Columbia, and Coos Bay, Oregon, and, you know, there are a limited number of port terminals in those places, there are a limited number of places where this infrastructure can be built, where pipelines can be built, where railroads can be built. And what we've seen is that some people call it whack-a-mole, but there aren't so many that you can't whack all the moles. There really is the sense that if you can't, in that swath of territory that I just described, basically, you know, what I think of as the sort of coastal Pacific Northwest, we can lock that stuff down. And by doing that, we prevent this huge outflow, both of Bakken oil, but also the heavy Canadian oils, possibly of liquefied natural gas and coals, for sure. You know, I think the question of what the ultimate destination for that oil is a little bit uncertain and will probably evolve over time. I mean, right now, most of that Bakken would be heading to California refineries or Puget Sound refineries. A little bit would end up on Pacific markets abroad. But going forward, I mean, there's every reason to think that the ultimate destination for that stuff is Asia, particularly if the export ban gets lifted.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Sightline principals, Nick Abraham, who is a fellow at Sightline, editor of the Oil Check Northwest, and Eric DePlace, who is the Sightline policy director for Sightline. And we're talking this morning about kind of the changing atmosphere and shifting ground under oil exploration in the Arctic, and how since the last time we had Eric and Nick on, many things have changed. When we were just talking of, 2 months ago, the Fenica was on its way, or actually was still stuck in the Portland Harbor and hadn't been able to get past the barricades at the St. John's Bridge. Since then, it's got up to Alaska. They drilled for a couple months and then they pulled out. The other interesting part of this, and I'm not sure whether Nick or Eric wants to jump in and talk about this, is that shortly after Shell decided not to no longer try to drill in the Arctic, or at least not for now, the Obama administration announced a 2-year cancellation of oil leases in the Arctic. So what do you make of that?
Well, I think there's a little bit more headway that's been made by groups like Greenpeace about this announcement. It is very significant, but I don't think it's significant for some of the reasons they've been giving. The reason I think it's significant is that there wasn't a lot of interest from companies after seeing what happened with Shell in the Arctic. It wasn't so much a political maneuver as it was just there weren't enough candidates, there weren't enough people that they saw wanting leases in the next 2 years. And that's sort of the reason that the Department of Interior gave for canceling it.
So I know that there's been a lot of pressure put on Obama. Well, actually, there was pressure being put on him while the Fenica was here in Portland to cancel Shell's lease in the Arctic back in August and to take a firm stand on no more drilling in the Arctic. So do you think that if there were still oil companies that wanted to drill up there, that the Obama administration would be sanguine about this kind of compromise that they see that they cut about Arctic drilling?
You know, so far in his administration, they've been pretty open to allowing for drilling on public lands. That's something that a lot of groups have been pushing for him to stop, for the Department of the Interior, for the EPA. But so far, they've been very open to expansion on public lands. Coal leases have been plummeting in price, but there's still been no move to cut those. Oil drilling in the Gulf got reopened, fairly quickly after the BP oil disaster. So and if you look at exactly what happened with the Arctic, they gave them the leases despite all the protests in the Northwest and on the national scale. So I don't think that those protests and the action put enough pressure on him to cancel those, I think it had a lot more to do with the lack of interest.
Well, there's a lot of people that argue that this is the way we're going to stop all this excessive exploration and drilling for fossil fuels is for it to no longer make business sense. And there's the whole idea of putting a price on nature and the natural capital theories. And they all kind of feed into this thing of like, well, let's, instead of being idealistic, let's be realistic and let's just look at the business models and how they don't work anymore. So do you think that there's some efficacy to that view, or do you feel we need to still hold on to the ideals that we have about why we shouldn't be drilling in the Arctic?
I think both are important factors to look at. I don't want to downplay the significance of the announcement from the Department of Interior. I think it's huge for protecting that area and for just national scale looking at drilling leases not being given out. But I think we do need to look at it from that point of view, that it no longer makes business sense for people to be drilling in areas like this, because it's incredibly expensive, it's incredibly dangerous to be drilling up there, and the price of oil doesn't have it make sense right now. So I think that's, you know, sort of more that natural capital theory that you're talking about. Plays a lot more into that mindset, but it's no less significant that they canceled it because of that reason.
Well, what was
the one thing I just want to chime in real quick. One thing I like to point out is I think the two are actually related in lots of ways. I mean, one of the things that we do when we make a sort of moral call to not drill in a place like the Arctic, or a moral call not to establish a huge oil train terminal in downtown Vancouver, Washington, or so on and so forth, is we drive up the costs for those industries. And so I think we absolutely should never abandon sort of our idealism, the moral belief that some of these industries are just wrong, they're destructive, and we should continue to talk about them in that way because they are. But what happens in that case is that that drives up their cost structure, it changes the nature of their markets, and then it's the case that the business model isn't there for them, the business case isn't there for them, and the economics look a lot better for renewable energy or for efficiency or for anything that's not the sort of most destructive industries on the planet. And so I really see those as pairing quite nicely, even though they're kind of philosophically different worldviews. I think they're importantly connected to one another.
Well, there's another area too. I mean, I'm reading this book right now by Andrew Nikifora called Slick Water, about fracking in Alberta, and it is a scary, depressing nightmare. And I mean, it's an interesting book, and I'm going to have him on in a few weeks. But I, as I'm reading it, one thing that came to my mind when the last time I interviewed Sandra Steingraber, and she was saying fracking is the issue. That's a paramount issue. That's the one everybody should get. It's the worst thing going on. And I said to her in a little voice, "Oh, what about tar sands?" But her point was that fracking goes on in everybody's backyard, and or can has the potential, which is what what Andrew Nikifora uncovers in this book. But I'm thinking that here in the Northwest, we are so far removed, except if you're in Anacortes and a couple other places, you're really far removed from the oil industry. And we live in kind of blissful ignorance of what kind of processes go on in communities that allow us to drive our car and pay, at this point, $2.50 a gallon for gasoline. And that it's important that we really share with people in this region what it would mean if these installations got built, because it would transform our quality of life so bad. It wouldn't be quite the same as having a fracking site 100 feet from your front door, but it still is really a major change. And I wonder how we do that kind of education so people start to understand what the fossil fuel industrialized landscape really looks like.
Yeah, I'd like to. That's just a great way to think about it. And I'm fascinated by what's happened with the advent of the oil train industry, because, as you say, unless you lived in like a little refining community like Anacortes or Ferndale, Washington, the oil industry seems very removed from our lives. Like, we have the luxury of sort of driving our cars without being sort of impacted by the other parts of the industry we have in the Northwest. When the oil train started running in late 2012, really sort of cranking up in 2013, 2014, all of a sudden it was the case that, you know, people were seeing these mile-long trains running through their downtowns, running through their communities, and hearing stories about them blowing up and killing people in some cases. And, you know, in some ways it was the beginning of a catalyzing moment where people realized, wow, this industry that I participate in as a retail consumer actually has an upstream, and the upstream aspects of it are potentially catastrophic. And so, you know, I've been really interested to watch the way in which the oil trains have made kind of tangible and visceral for people what the nature of the of fracking is, because this is fracked shale oil that's traveling through communities in the Northwest, what the nature of the oil industry is. And, you know, it's been funny because over the last couple of months we've seen, you know, on like network evening news, at least in Seattle, these kind of long-form explorations of, wait a second, we have oil trains traveling by the stadiums, by the Seahawks, by the Mariners. What if they blow up? What's going to happen to the fans? And it's really, you know, it's the kind of conversation that's reaching sort of a mass popular audience, you know, that our movement has struggled to do for years and years. But in a way, the oil industry is its own worst enemy right now, because it is, you know, it is engaged in, you know, this fundamentally risky, unsafe endeavor of moving combustible oil by rail through the heart of small towns and big cities. And I'm optimistic that we're having something of an awakening right now in the Northwest about this stuff.
Well, when I come up to Seattle, I stay with friends who live in Finney Ridge, and they've got this great view of the city from their ridgetop. And one of the things you see are the trains coming by, including the oil trains. And the last time I stayed there was shortly after one of those trains derailed. Fortunately, it wasn't loaded. But is a real graphic sense. I mean, and the same thing's true in Portland. I don't know that the trains don't really go through downtown Portland the same way they go through downtown Seattle, but they go along the gorge and they go through a lot of neighborhoods, and particularly the North Portland area is really impacted. So I wonder about how that just like the visualness of this is like really changing the way people start to relate to maybe the gas that they're putting in their cars.
I think it has to be. I mean, just the number of people I hear sort of anecdotally talking about the media attention that that is now on these issues, and you know, honestly, like a lot of the media attention is not fundamentally driven by environmental concerns or by climate concerns, but it's driven by public health and safety, which, you know, honestly, I think is a very reasonable way for people to come to the issue. Like, you know, if we're going to put, you know, tens of thousands of fans into the Seahawks stadium on a Sunday afternoon and run oil trains next door to them, it's perfectly reasonable, I think, for a football fan who may not care about the environment all that much to think, wow, I'm going to get blown up with my family because of some irresponsible oil industry that's insisting on moving this stuff with complete disregard to public safety, it seems like. I think that is the first step on the realization that the fossil fuel industry is bad for us on a whole range of measures, not just about sort of conventional environmental issues, but it's inimical to our way of life, sometimes literally. And so I guess, you know, I think there is really some power in the visual and tangible nature of seeing oil, you know, whether it's in a pipeline or whether it's in a train or what have you, but seeing that infrastructure around us, I think it tends to change people, and I think it tends to change people for the better.
Well, I'm thinking actually if people, enough Seahawks fans got really shocked and nerve rattled by thinking that they could be sitting at a game and be blown up by one of these oil trains, and so attendance at the Seahawks game started to fall off, maybe you'd get the Seahawks themselves actually coming out against the oil trains.
Well, we actually saw a little bit of this with the Mariners. They BNSF is a major sponsor of the team, and they had a sponsorship with the home run. So every time at home games, when the Mariners hit a home run, they put BNSF had the byline for it, and on the screen on the stadiums it would say BNSF Blast. Which, now that we know what's happening with oil trains in the Northwest and their proximity to the stadium, there was a huge outcry from fans and from local activists saying, "You got to be kidding me with this! The irony of your statement here." I mean, and they actually ended up changing the name of it. But there's, you know, every time the trains go by the stadium, they used to blow their horn, and it was sort of this nice, fun dynamic between the team and the city and the fans. And now it's become an ominous sound, and they don't have as cozy a relationship with the team or the fans. And I think it's really woken up a new demographic of the city to these issues, and it's really important and really interesting to see.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Eric DePlace and Nick Abraham, who are both with Sightline Institute, and we're talking about shifting consciousness and actually some policy differences, changes about first we start, we're talking about drilling oil in the Arctic, and I'm going to move now to some more generic kind of oil issues. We've been talking about oil trains. I wanted to talk for a moment, this is not something that I'm not sure if any of either of you are prepared for, but the other big thing in the news for the last week has been the Exxon scandal. And I did a show about it a couple weeks ago, but it wasn't, actually I thought my guest wasn't really well prepared. So I just kind of curious about what you're seeing in the fallout of the revelations that Exxon for years was doing cutting edge climate change research and discovering all these things back in the late 70s, early 80s that we now know are true. But they knew it back 35 years ago about seawater rise, about the climate change being much more dramatic in the Arctic region and Antarctic. And so instead of using this information to change their business philosophy and move away from drilling for fossil fuels, they just instead, in the fashion of the cigarette industry, hired some great PR firms and some scientists to spin it in terms of uncertainty and climate uncertainty. And they were in the forefront of promoting the idea that climate change is really an uncertain science. And now that's coming out, even Hillary Clinton, I saw a couple of days ago, is calling for the Justice Department to investigate Exxon. So I'm wondering about your thoughts on this and how this kind of feeds into the same kind of potential fossil fuel demise that Shell oil is facing.
It's probably one of the most significant revelations in the fight against climate change in the last 10 years. Exxon coming out and saying, you know, it's one thing for revelations to find that Exxon was sowing doubt and that they were funding denialism and that they were, you know, giving donations to politicians that then came out against you know, emissions reductions and pollution controls. But for the revelation to come out that their own scientists had found significance with emissions and climate change and had been going to conferences, had been doing studies, had been getting interviewed on this topic, they were doing some of the best science and the most compelling stuff of that era. And then for them to turn around and use that information to sow doubt and completely shift their company's mindset is it's incredible, to be honest. And it's something that should be criminally prosecuted. Hillary Clinton, like you said, came out in sort of a offhand statement. It wasn't an official announcement, but somebody asked her about it at a rally, and she said, absolutely, they should be prosecuted. Bernie Sanders has done the same. And there's been talk at the Justice Department and internally with the House Democrats about pursuing this because there's a real case there.
So what do you think it means? I mean, actually, the guest that I had on a few weeks ago who wrote for The Nation was talking about the RICO suit that Sheldon Whitehouse has been suggesting. What do you think there are chances that Exxon could been called up on RICO charges for racketeering in terms of their manipulation and of sowing doubt about climate science?
Well, I think there's plenty of evidence that they have been sowing doubt. And that's one thing. That can be sort of seen as a difference in opinion, or you can spin that a lot of different ways. But to now know that they had the information and that they were some of the best and earliest informed on this really plays into going for that RICO case. They, like I said, the Justice Department is looking at trying to prosecute them, and they haven't made any formal announcements. But there's a really good chance that this could happen. You know, unfortunately, Exxon still has incredible political power and backing financially for a lot of politicians in the United States. But it's there's a real opportunity there to get them criminally prosecuted.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, Exxon stock prices really shot way up, it kind of in the face of the scandal, which I thought was a little bit disconcerting. So I'm wondering how much Exxon is really, what kind of actual penalties they may be facing compared to Shell, who is like has a growing uncertain future as a result of their failure in the Arctic this summer.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, this all came from a fairly small research group. It's Inside Climate News, and it's I was actually a little bit shocked to see it get spread to so much mainstream media. But I think it's because of the just visceralness of the information. You know, people realizing that they knew about this before, they get very angry about it, and it's something that everybody is concerned about. But to know that companies are doing this so on purpose, it's incredible. So I think the financial ramifications will come when there are more real consequences. You know, Shell's was a dollar amount, you know, $7.4 billion that they spent in the Arctic without any results. Exxon's is still yet to be seen, but if anything was filed criminally, their stock price would take an incredible hit.
Well, I keep thinking back to the cigarette industry, and it took a long time to get the cigarette industry in the crosshairs of the Justice Department. But when it happened, it certainly transformed that industry, though I guess now they're moving towards other evil ways of spreading tobacco through e-cigarettes or whatever else, and still obfuscating about it. But I wonder, I think that overall people see the tobacco industry as kind of a bunch of evildoers. And I wonder if, some people think the same way about the oil industry, but it seems that on Wall Street, the oil industry still has, is much more of a favorite child than the tobacco industry is these days.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comparison, and I think you're absolutely right that they are a much bigger player on the national scene than tobacco is. But that's because they got criminally prosecuted. They used to be they were just as powerful as the oil industry was back in, you know, say like the 70s. But it's incredible to see, you know, the changes that have happened in mindset just from a story like this. People just see it as so much more significant that they knew. I mean, imagine if Exxon had come out when these scientists had said this and said, this is absolutely happening, we're going to change our practices, and we're going to spend the next 30 decades transitioning to a form of energy that's not going to pollute the air. If a company that was producing the oil had said that, we would have shifted over at a dramatically faster pace. But because there's this, you know, he said, she said, you know, this side says this, this side says the other thing, we've delayed and delayed and delayed, and it would have changed everything if they had come out and come out with some significance on this issue.
Well, what really blew my mind was in reading the Inside Climate Change article that Exxon, and back in the late 70s, was wanting to be on the cutting edge of climate science, and they wanted to be a leader in actually looking in new directions for the fossil fuel industry. And what I've been trying to figure out, because it's not really clear in those articles, is what shifted at Exxon so they went from supporting good science and actually thinking of, I mean, they were wanting to be ahead of the curve. It seemed like it was always a business decision. We want to know what's up ahead so we can plan for it. But it sounded like in the late 70s, early 80s, the plans included changing their business practices considerably. And then by the mid 80s, it was all about climate denial.
Yeah, and there was a few changes in leadership at Exxon, but I think, you know, from my own, this is my own opinion on what I think happened. I think there's still a lot to be determined on why they shifted, but I think once there was actual public outcry for action on climate change, once the public consciousness was starting to change, I think they saw the writing on the wall of what that would mean for their company. And because they didn't have the wherewithal or the infrastructure to change their energy practices, you know, which direction they were going to go, they made the decision that they were going to delay and obfuscate this as much as possible.
Well, talking about a will for change, I want to finish by talking about this hearing that's going on in City Hall in Portland on Wednesday, and I want Eric to get back in the conversation. What do you see? What do you see are sort of what's up right now in terms of this proposal to ban fossil fuel terminals and other infrastructure in the city of Portland? And it's being proposed by our mayor for the next year, Charlie Hales, who was the big backer of the Pembina liquid propane terminal, which then he pulled the plug on when he realized he wouldn't get reelected if he continued that. And Amanda Fritz, who has a consistent stand about climate change and fossil fuels. But the rest of the city commissioners are kind of up in the air. I haven't heard any of the other three actually coming out strongly in favor of this. So I'm wondering if you have any ideas of like what is happening underfoot and what this means and what people can do to make sure that this proposal actually becomes a regulation.
Yeah. So let me answer the end of that question first, which is what people can do is to contact everyone who's in city government, the mayor, the council members, and staff as well, to make clear that this is something that resonates with Portland, that this is consistent with Portland's values. And to me, you know, I love that Mayor Hales has brought forward this resolution, and I think it was, you know, as you just said, he was the backer of a liquid propane terminal that would have been, I think, a terrible idea for Portland. But in the face of sustained and vehement public opposition, he changed his mind. And now not only did he change his mind and ice that propane terminal, but now he's advancing what I believe to be the strongest resolution on fossil fuels anywhere in the country right now. If Portland is successful in passing this, we will have a template and a model that we can begin to roll out in other places around the Pacific Northwest and other places around the country, because this really is taking as comprehensive and as firm a stand as a municipal government possibly can do, and say this is not who we are. It's an identity question to a large extent. It's a health and safety question, and it's a statement that says we need a different energy course, we need a different future, and that's going to have to, you know, in the face of inaction at the federal level, in the face of, you know, relative inaction at the state level, both in Oregon and Washington, quite honestly, you know, this is where people live. This is local government is the place where people interface most closely with politics. So I'm just, you know, I'm in awe watching this happen. I'm very hopeful that it will pass, and because I think Portland really is charting some important new terrain here.
So this would actually change city code, which is a pretty strong thing to change. I'm wondering how this compares to what you have going on in Seattle.
It's much stronger than what we have in Seattle. I mean, we have seen some very sort of robust and serious statements expressing the city's preferences, expressing what the city would like to get from the industry. And the city has asked repeatedly for more information from the rail and the oil industries, for some routing decisions. They've asked for information about commercial liability insurance, a whole range of issues. So I think Seattle's been great on this. But as you say, I mean, what's going on in Portland is actually trying to alter the code so that this stuff cannot get built there. You know, that is a huge change, and I think it redounds well not just to sort of Portland as kind of a this is who we are, this is what we believe sort of thing, but I really think that there's a long-term benefit to keeping the fossil fuel industry out. And I know we're running really short on time, but I did want to mention, you know, one of the most interesting stories right now in the Northwest is not just what's happening in Portland, but what's happening in Whatcom County, Washington, where Bellingham is located. There's a big coal terminal proposed there, and there has been this effort to buy the county council, basically. And the coal companies tried to do it a couple of years ago. They lost. Now they have basically gone through a charter review process, and they have on the ballot now this attempt to gerrymander the county. It didn't look like it was real. It didn't look like anybody was going to vote for it. And within the last week, they've dumped more than $100,000 into Little Whatcom County, Washington, to basically buy the politics. The reason I'm telling the story right at the end is because that's what's happening when you invite the fossil fuel industry to town. When the coal industry is there, when the oil industry is there, they will try to buy your politics. They will try to change the entire nature of your democracy. And so the reason I think what Portland is doing is important is not just as a stand for the environment, but as a protective measure to make sure that that the Northwest remains relatively unentangled with this pernicious and destructive industry.
Well, as someone who spent the last few years a lot of time in Richmond, California, it was at first disheartening to just really get deeply into just how controlled that city was by Chevron, and then to watch the city rise up and overthrow Chevron's political control of the city. But it does seem like it's a lot simpler not to have to overthrow the control that's been embedded for 100 years, and instead to do things proactively.
Absolutely. And, you know, and actually just across the river from Portland is another great example that's happening, where Tesoro, big, you know, Fortune 100 oil company, with a really long track record of playing, you know, hard-hitting bare-knuckle politics, they've got this huge proposal for an oil train terminal that's an environmental and safety threat to Vancouver, Washington. But my contention is it's a democratic threat to Vancouver, Washington. If Tesoro gets embedded there more than they already are with a lease at the port right now, their politics will change, and their democracy will change, and it will not change for the better for the folks who live there.
Well, I'm hoping that Portland can be a model for Vancouver, and this is a story like this. We should have you guys on again in the next couple months, and we'll kind of do an update on what's happening throughout all the terminal struggles and pipeline struggles and train struggles that we have throughout the Northwest.
I'm looking forward to it already.
Okay, me too. Well, thanks a whole lot for joining us, both of you. It was really good talking with you again. We've been talking this morning with Eric DePlace and Nick Abraham, who are with Sightline Institute, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in, you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, my guest is Adam Briggle, author of A Field Philosopher's Guide to Fret. A Field Philosopher's Guide to Fracking. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with Turn the Ship Around by Anna Fritz, which was recorded last August by the St. John's Bridge. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening.
Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground and turn the ships around. Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground and turn the ships around. Keep it going. Cascadia is a place of great power. We stand at the mouth of the river, rooted to the land and its people. We turn the ships around. Cascadia is a place of great power. We stand at the mouth of the river, rooted to the land and its people. We turn the ships around. Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground. Turn the ships around. We are a people. We are a people awakening. We are a people reclaiming. We are a people demanding. Turn the ships around. We are a people awakening.
Good morning, and it is so half a minute past 11 a.m. You do have it tuned to KBOO Portland, and coming up, standing by in the wings, is Health Watch with host Dr. David Naiman. Today he speaks with the authors of The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health, the story of our tangled relationship with microbes and their potential to revolutionize agriculture and medicine. Stay tuned at 11:30 on Madness Radio. Guardian columnist